Michael Warren.
Can I say a word of very warm welcome to you all to the IFG. This is the second in our series on the media and politics, which Nick Robinson is hosting. I myself is doing him a great service because he's writing a book, and I've told him that I will provide seminars. Provided with each seminar, he's written another two or three chapters by the time the seminar comes. I don't know if he's fulfilled his part of the bargain this time, but we want to see that book soon. The first of the seminars was before Christmas, in the middle of the snow, so we didn't have such a good turnout, but we did have the Director General of the BBC, who made some extraordinarily important statements, which weren't widely picked up, about how he didn't think that anybody besides himself should any more be obliged to observe impartiality. I'm sure we're going to have some equally far-reaching statements today from our panel. Nick and the panel need no introduction. Tom Kelly was the Prime Minister's official spokesman under Tony Blair. Hal James ran the whole of the media show in the Cabinet Office and Number 10. And Jonathan Powell was last here launching his book, The New Machiavelli, which he tells me is selling reasonably well. And he has copies here, which he will... The paperback with a new introduction is imminent and is now working on the next volume. Nick, it's all yours.
Thank you very much indeed. Andrew's real service to me is he knows that I'm a deadline merchant. And like all journalists, I'm a bit of a bullshitter. And therefore, if he just keeps saying in public that I'm writing a book, there is a possibility I might actually write it one day. Because at the moment, I have to say, prospects are a little... it's all not quite going to plan, but we'll get there eventually. Thank you very much for coming early this morning. What I've agreed with our panel here is that in order to understand the future, we should understand a little from the past, because each of our panelists here is here because they've played a very central role in government communication in some way, or at least observed it from the central power in Jonathan's case. And we have represented here, particularly in Hal James, someone who worked with four governments, in fact, but certainly three who have good reason to think they had an utterly miserable time at the hands of the press. John Major's, where he was political secretary, and then Tony Blair's and Gordon Brown's, where briefly under Gordon Brown, but longer over Tony Blair, he was permanent secretary of government communications for 4 years. So I'm going to ask each of them in turn to answer, fairly briefly if you will, because then it'll throw us forward, to answer these three questions. Which of those prime ministers had the worst press? And why? What is your worst horror story of what the press can do to a government, either grand or trivial? And what confession would you like to make before this little obscure gathering of when perhaps the government didn't treat the media quite just as well and candidly and honestly as it could have done? And Howell, if I may start with you, because as it were,
so unfair.
There's quite strong arguments as to each of Major, Blair and Brown having the bloodiest time in the relationship with the media, but do you have a view as to who had it worst and why?
I think Blair is more has sort of stormed to the front of the charts rather latter day. I'm not sure that applies necessarily within his government period, although you know there were some high points in that regard. I think if you're looking at a close tie between Major and Brown, I'd probably give Gordon Brown the honours in terms of the worst, you know, drubbing. And partly because I it always seems to me that John Major, you know, there was some justification in a way in that we did not have a majority, so we could not deliver a programme. So we were actually staggering from one vote in the House to the next. There were, on two or three occasions, I think, we just saved ourselves by a whisker in the autumn of 96 and the spring of 97. And therefore, you know, it was legitimate to say that the government was at sixes and sevens and in a parlous state. Gordon, of course, had a proper majority. I mean, he could have delivered a programme. And it seemed to me that the confusion did derive from a lack of grip and a lack of clarity about purpose, and I think therefore, you know, he in some ways he had more cards in his hand, and therefore, you know, the media probably getting the worst.
While you come to the answer to the other two questions, let me bring in the other two on who had the worst press and why, and obviously because the session is about government communications, to what extent government communications was the reason. Tom, I mean, your boss at the time, Tony Blair, talked about the feral beasts. Was he the worst sufferer from the feral beasts, or do you think actually John Major and Gordon Brown suffered rather more?
At times it felt like it. You know, we accumulated
I've forgotten how many worst weeks ever for a prime minister. This is the week when Tony Blair finally lost it. We can have quite a number of those.
Well over those.
At times, Cash for Honours springs to mind as a particular time whenever things were particularly bad, and it did get very personal and very emotional. But I think, I was thinking about your question earlier, and John Major, my memory from the outside, is that at times it did get very personal, and there was the Steve Bell cartoons and so on. So it did go from that balance of, if you like, criticism towards ridicule at times. But I don't think it ever actually got to pity. And pity, I think, is where it really does get dangerous for a politician if you're pitied. And the reality, I think, was, and I actually found it at times very painful to watch, was Gordon Brown did descend from criticism to ridicule to pity. And at times, you almost felt like, I wish somebody would just show the door and get it over and done with.
They did try, Tom.
They tried. And Jonathan, I have no doubt, has views on how well they tried. When you get to that stage where actually you're being pitied not just on an occasional basis, but on a constant basis, I think that puts Gordon Brown in the category.
Natural sympathiser with Gordon Brown next, Jonathan Powell.
Natural shield for Gordon Brown. Well, Machiavelli would certainly agree with Tom that contempt is the worst possible thing that can happen to a leader, and that's what finishes them off. I'm going to have a typically third way answer and say all three of them, in that John Major had the worst press, I think, and that is partly because he cared about it so much. I was really struck by the way when he used to come to the embassy in Washington, he would draw into the bedroom with all of the newspapers and agonize over them.
Oh, God, I tried to stop it.
Yeah, he couldn't.
Tried so hard.
Every edition of the Evening Standard would come in, he'd come out of the cabinet room and take it back in and agonise. He really cared. Yeah. And politicians are much better off when they don't care quite so much about the media. It's difficult because they make their careers through the media. They become leaders, David Cameron has and Tony Blair did, through the media. So they find it difficult to let go. But Thatcher and Blair didn't read the newspapers unless they absolutely had to. Major obsessed about them, and that's why I think one of the reasons why he cared about the press so much and why it was worse for him. I think Tony had the most undeserved bad press, but he actually had the ability to sort of slough it off and not take it too bad. Gordon Brown, I think, had deserved bad press, so he would be up there too. He did get contempt. I think that's partly because he and the truth had a little bit of a sort of distance from each other. But it was not just that; it was also that he was too close to the press. He'd bring you people up and talk to you directly, which Tony was pretty unreluctant to ever do. He tried to get right into it.
Fairly briefly, I'm going to get you to go through, because there's so much to talk about, but get you to go through the answers to those other two questions then, Hal. What's your horror memory, and what's your confession?
Horror memory is not a criticism of the media, it's a criticism of the politicians who gave the media the gift, which was the week before, I think, we called the 97 general election. We were in the lead-up, there was a lot of focus and attention, and we opened the Sun, I think, on the Tuesday morning, and there was Piers Merchant with his hand up a young lady's skirt in a park. And an alleged photograph, and we were just getting over that one when I was on a regional tour with the Prime Minister, and he was off somewhere else, and I got a phone call from the Scottish Party that same week, where an MP, I think called Alan Stewart, had obviously having a bad afternoon, had run out of his house with an axe and had taken to, I think, laying about the car. I hope it was the car of the next door neighbour. I hope it wasn't the next door neighbour. And I phoned John Major and said, he said, oh God, now what's happened? You know, Piers Merchant again. Oh, no, I said, no, there's now someone new. And so my memory is of that week of you know, worst moments, just the cumulative effect of circumstances leading to
We'll come back to me on confessionals.
Yeah. I haven't got an instant one.
Tom, you mentioned Cash for Honours. Is that your worst moment, or was there a specific incident?
No, MMR is my worst one. MMR came relatively early in my time at Number 10, and MMR had all the horror elements of a real issue that involved the Prime Minister's family, and how much do you say?
Just to remind people, that was because he wouldn't answer the question whether he'd given the jab to his
son. Yeah, to Leo. And perfectly good reasons why we wouldn't answer the questions, except, as always, you start off with perfectly good reasons, which the longer you go into something, the more it seems, well, maybe that wasn't quite the right answer.
And the learning point from it? Is that you have done it differently?
The learning point, I think, was that we didn't put enough effort right at the start into getting the media to properly understand MMR. What the reason it was so painful was because you would start off what turned into an hour and a half lobby sessions on one subject, and you realized about 20 minutes in that you were talking not to journalists but to parents. So it became very personal and very vindictive in many ways as well. The confession, well, there's so many, but let me choose one that lives in my memory, which is reshuffles, I hate it. Reshuffles, there was only one rule as far as I could go about reshuffles, they were going to go wrong. The one I hit at most was when we tried to abolish the Welsh office and the Scottish office, and about a third of the way into this lobby, Michael White, who I respect enormously, said something like, "Tom, you do realise that what you're proposing to do is unconstitutional." And this mental sort of image of somebody on screen, the nameplates from the Scottish office and the Welsh office, and just starting to screw them back in again, just as he asked the question. And it was clear we just hadn't thought it through.
Jonathan?
For me, I could be cash for honours, partly because it went on for so long, it went on for every year, and partly because the police would keep planting stories in the newspapers, and we really couldn't respond effectively. The stories were essentially untrue, pretty much all of them, but we couldn't respond to any of them, so that became really, really difficult and frustrating, and I find myself taking it too personally. As I said, my first rule is you shouldn't take the stuff personally, you have to treat it as business. And when people are impugning you and suggesting you're going to jail, it's quite hard to do that.
Do you have a view of what either government communications could have done, or do you just hold the media to blame for it?
No, I don't hold the media to blame for it, I hold the police to blame for it. The problem we've got is we do follow American politics about 5 years after the event. And what we're doing now is going down a sort of whitewater channel where we're going to have, and this will happen to this government too if they last long enough, you end up having a series of investigations, you spend all your time and effort doing that. That's really not what you want your politicians doing.
Mm-hmm. And your confessional?
Confession, not a terribly exciting one, but the one relating to that. I remember being at a dinner in the House of Lords as the cash run and stuff was breaking, and sitting next to Mark Thompson and berating him for how terrible it was that you and the News at 10 had been leading on this story, and how could you give such significance to such an important story. At half time, I got a call from Michael Levy saying he was being arrested the next day. And then having to sit down to Mark Thompson and somehow drop my original argument without actually hearing
it. Yes, I got the call anyway. I'll talk about that later.
I've got one confessional, which is the major leadership campaign. Where,
this is 1995 when you said
1995, Bat Meal sat me. He stood down as leader of the Conservative Party but remained Prime Minister, certainly during the campaign at least. And we all knew on the campaign that he was extremely uncertain about the outcome here. And many of us, of course, debated why had he done this if he wanted to stay? You know, surely this was a mechanism to go with honour in some way. And, of course, we were constantly being asked, what will it take to get rid of him? And I remember standing in front of about 70 journalists in the basement of the Palais de Film in Cannes at a social ministers' conference in the south of France. In the middle of this campaign, we were shipped off there. Christopher Mayer, of course, was the press secretary, but he couldn't field any of these questions. So I went down, and I stood in front of them, and they said, what is the margin he needs? And, we all knew that it needed to be substantial, but we said one vote is enough, one vote is enough, one vote is enough. And I stood there saying one vote is enough, knowing full well, I'm afraid, that it wasn't.
The audience, if you're watching on the internet, are shocked.
There, indeed.
Now, let me invite you, and then I want to give other people the opportunity to ask some questions as well. The opportunity to assess where you think the coalition are in terms of government communications, and to give them some advice. And let me just, because it's early in the morning, just give you a few kind of thoughts to chew on, if you like, which is they have a number of issues. One is, how does a coalition communicate, given that there are two parties? What's your verdict on how that's going? Do you think they should look again at the issues that the Phyllis Committee looked at Howell, you were on the Phyllis Committee that looked at the possibility of televising lobby briefings and with ministers appearing before journalists. And the issue that was so crucial in the Blair government that Jonathan and Tom played such an important part in was obviously the balance between political briefing and official briefing. And the question now, interestingly, I think, for this government is exactly how that goes. So a few thoughts on that, if you would. Tom, do you want to kick us off on that?
Firstly, coalition. One of the many ways, number 10 in my time felt like a coalition. I think there's a lot actually have it easier in that it's at least acknowledged to be a coalition at the moment. In terms of where I think they are.
They do talk to each other, which helps as well.
Well, so I gather. That must be quite a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
See if it lasts.
In terms of how they go, look, this was always going to be the interesting period because this was always the period when the theory of deficit reduction hits the reality of cuts. And you know, government communication is about, in my view, being at that nexus between policy and hard reality. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how they respond to that. I also think it's interesting in that I think what they're beginning to learn, and I'm afraid learn the hard way, is that it's all very well saying the departments should do their own thing. But in the end, everything ends up coming through the front door and the back door of number 10. You, in the end, have no choice, in my view, but to grip it from the centre and drive it from the centre. And I think if you look back over the last few weeks, whether it's forestry privatisation, whether it's Libya, no matter what it is, it ends up at the back door. The third point I would make is you've got to always not just deal with today, tomorrow, but 6 months, a year, 2 years down the track. And you know, I'd simply mention the example of NHS at this point. You know, I remember, and I think you were there, doing lobby briefings about old ladies on trolleys in 2001. You do not want to get to that point again. Irrespective of whether policy is right or wrong, they need to be doing that kind of advanced thinking. In terms of, I was in Phyllis as well, and you know, I was, I think, actually one of the dissenters in terms of changing the lobby system. And my view in changing the lobby system is I can argue it out theoretically, etc., etc., etc. The country's going through a difficult time. Will the country understand if all your attention goes on communication? In my view, no. It's a fight just not worth having. So why start it?
You mean the struggle to change the system would be a fight not worth having? Or you mean the visibility of some anonymous, previously anonymous official on television?
No, I think the struggle to change it is just not worth having.
Because the lobby would fight.
Because the print media would fight it. I don't think it's actually worth it in terms of what benefits it brings. I don't think that's where the country is moving at the moment.
Incidentally, I pick up no sense that this government's thinking of doing it. But
I was a sceptic about the television lobby because it seems to me the lobby is the lobby. And once you've televised it, it's a television press conference, and we see that in America. And the dilemma, the logistical dilemma of who you put up, I think, you know, charming and attractive as Tom is, you know, putting him up every day on the television, it will make him, you know, a minor celebrity, and will distract, you know, from the Prime Minister's role as the whipper end of all government messages, and will also create tensions with other ministers who like to wear their own messages and go up in front of the television defending their pitch. So I think the televised and the lobby was... In that sense, was never a runner. The middle path we got to, the third way which we got to, which was the monthly press conference, it seemed to me where the Prime Minister stood up and did that stuff was correct. The difference we had to keep reminding ourselves on for this was that we are a parliamentary democracy here. It's not a presidency. The presidency can run its comms in one way. A parliamentary democracy cannot stand up and give television conferences in the morning, pre-announcing and trailing stuff, and not expect the House of Commons to be deeply offended and create a complete distraction. The one argument that I thought was very compelling, however, in favour of it, was that it would change journalistic behaviour. That that over time, that the media would see its own behaviours refracted through the television, and the remorseless, you know, the capacity to keep asking the same question and asking it in that very aggressive way that, that Tom knows only too well at the lobby, would be diminished because on television they would be nervous about that.
Interesting.
And you may be able to respond to that.
I may be. I'm open to question afterwards. No. Now, in a certain book I have here, it says a prudent prime minister should try to put the relationship between the media and politicians on a new footing before their honeymoon is over. But I doubt they will, and anyway, technology will resolve the problem. So what did you mean, Jonathan, a new footing? Do you think they've failed to do it, and how might technology resolve the problem?
Yes, they have failed to do it. For politicians in a democracy, it's incredibly important to be able to communicate with the public. What they need to be able to do is to explain, to get their message across. And if the media gets in the way, instead of refracting the message, actually blocks the message, they get incredibly frustrated, as you saw with Clinton in 93-94. And they try and find ways past it. By what Clinton did was he had a big TV truck parked next to the old executive office building, and he'd go out and do back-to-back interviews with Nebraska TV and so on, to try and get past it. We did it by local campaigning too. There was a real problem. And what happened to us at the end of our time, or actually from about the middle of our time, is we ended up in this sort of standoff with the press. And I'm prepared to admit at least part of the point of fault was ours. You know, we learned the lessons of opposition too well. We got too aggressive at rebuttal, for example. It is a mistake to leave stories unrebutted, as John Kerry found out in the presidential election on the Swift Boat veterans, where he allowed a story to stand because he thought it was so ridiculous that he didn't need to rebut it. And it really, he really suffered from it as a result. You do need to rebut. If you get too aggressive in doing that, you lose the press. If you try and be too clever at playing off the sun against the mirror, you lose the press. And if you, basically, if you become, spin becomes the message and spin doctor is the story, then you've got a real problem. So we're at least half to blame. I think the media, though, were at least half to blame the other side. They seem to have acquired a sort of form of attention deficit disorder where they need the narrative to change every week. Or else they get bored. They want something new to write about. And you see it with celebs too now. Celebs last about sort of 3 weeks rather than 3 years before they're chewed up, and it's true of politics. I think the competition between newspapers and the declining television news watchership is causing a problem. People reach for shock and awe to try and get attention. Instead of trying to illuminate a subject, they try and generate heat, and I don't think that's terribly helpful to politicians explaining what they're doing. Perhaps the worst thing is that the comments and reporting have merged together into one. It used to be you'd have some reporting and then you'd have some comment. Now you have both together, and I think that really, really is difficult for politicians.
Why did you think, forgive me to interrupt, the internet might be the solution? Or part of it?
Well, because as my problem, what I was talking about there was specifically accountability of the media. The media seems to me to have no accountability. Dacre says that as long as he sells his newspapers, he's accountable. That's nonsense, like a politician saying he doesn't need to tell the truth as long as he gets re-elected. It's not a sensible answer. There needs to be some way of holding the press to account. It isn't going to happen through the PCC. It's not going to happen through a statutory PCC. But as online becomes more and more important, as people get their information, as television, the press, all information merges. My grown-up children get their news entirely through online now. People in America, Huffington Post, etc. That's going to be where it goes. That will answer the problem in the end. It won't be the newspapers holding everyone to account.
But arguably, it could be worse. I mean, blogs are often less respectful of the truth, less respectful of balance,
but you have
less respectful of politicians.
Yeah, I know it's not answering the politicians' ability to communicate. It answers the issue of regulation, because regulation will go out the window. What we discussed last time.
Understood. I'm going to open it up to a few questions and comments and then pursue some others. Peter Riddle at the back.
One observation and a question. The observation is, of course, the televised news conferences, which the PM has done, in a sense, illustrated the point Howell's making of becoming theatrical events, which they are, except, of course, over time, they become less noticed. They become more routine. They started off as great dramas, but now they're just part of the furniture. Unless there's something really dramatic externally happening, the mere holding of them has become less interesting. They're much less well-attended than they were at the beginning, unless something's dramatic. The question I wanted to ask was Tom and Howell, because after their period in government, they moved on to slightly uncontroversial corporate posts of various kinds. I'd invite them both to compare the pressures. I mean, Al, you've had a few recent interesting pressures at Barclays.
Even today.
And Tom, you have in various ways. But comparing the pressures you have there and dealing with businessmen as opposed to dealing with politicians in handling some of the things you've described earlier on.
Just rudely rudely, not you, Peter, didn't tell everybody your current post. Tom is at the FSA, Al is at Barclays, and was just expressing his regret before that he wasn't one of the five top. paid officials. But now is your chance to put your pay back.
I was asked whether I was, and I regretted it in that context.
We give you this opportunity. Precious, more or less.
Well, they're similar, actually, because, they're similar because, you know, when you are in the eye of a media storm, the media just focuses very, very intently on you, and it moves very fast, and you have to have all the, mechanisms in place that we know from government, that you have to be clear about what you want to say, you have to be clear about how far you want to go, you have to think through the consequences of answers, and you have to be constantly alert to the hostage and where the thing's going to go next. And so it's a not dissimilar position. I mean, the interesting thing for me, particularly through the autumn of 08 and the spring of 09, when the financial crisis was absolutely at its peak, was to be at the receiving end of the lobby process, which is you'd wake up in the morning and a political editor has written a story about banking. Now, for a long time, the only people who wrote stories about banking were banking editors and banking correspondents, and they appeared on the financial page. And of course, what happened was it moved into the news. It moved from print into broadcast, and it became much, much more intense and more visible. And of course, politicians felt they had, and they did have a stake in the game, and they wanted to shape the story. So political editors would write stories based entirely on briefings from politicians inside the Treasury or elsewhere, which, was the one thing that was the most difficult, I think, for senior management in financial services companies, was to understand what the motivation of that was and where that was coming from and how to control it, because it appeared to be such a shadow boxing game. And I think explaining that to them was one of the challenges.
Were you, and you didn't say this, so you may not think this, but were you saying actually stories from the lobby are harder because they're more often tosh? There is a subtext to the argument about government communications, which is that the lobby, and those people, I'm in it, so yeah. Declare an interest, as it were, often writes rubbish and makes it up. I read a famous story the other day about the beginning of the lobby in 1870 when, under Gladstone, it started, and Gladstone bumped into a man from the Times who was sitting on a stair blocking his way and just asked him to move out of the way in order to get where it was. That was the extent of the conversation, and the Times had a story that said, I spoke to the Prime Minister yesterday and he told me. Then added a whole series of quotes from Gladstone's recent speeches. Yeah. Lobby journalism was thus born.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's serious.
Well, I think the most insidious thing about the lobby, because I always defend your and Peter's and Benedict's and others' profession when dealing with people, which is I don't think you make things up. I think you write what you're told. And I think, people choose to go and tell you half-truths and bits of nonsense and scuttlebutt out of cabinet meetings and ministerial subcommittees. You can't be held to blame, although it would be nice, obviously, to feel there's a sense of reassurance that you're checking it with two or three others before doing so. But the culture that it creates is the issue. And I think the interesting point you made about the police, and you blame the police. The police were only doing what politicians had taught them. And,
well, they're not politicians.
And no, but unfortunately, the whole world now thinks. They watched your the new Labour's sort of great professionalism in opposition through that period. They watched your translation of that, as you yourself said, into government, and they thought this was the way to do it. Right. And if I had a pound for every corporate chief or senior public figure who said, I wish I had a Peter Mandelson, I wish I had an Alistair Campbell, everyone wanted a slice of this proactive, we're happening to the media isn't happening to us, we're fighting back, we've got control of the news cycle, we're rebutting, and it set a sort of mood in all sorts of corners of life where it's surprising to find it. And I think, the cash flow, as it always seemed to me, was the lobby system had sort of translated itself and empowered the police to run around, telling half stories and telling the media in that way. And that's what we have to ask ourselves about the benefits or disbenefits of the lobby.
Now, Tom, before you were at the FSA, you were at British Airports Authority, which had its fair share of troubleshooting stories.
Surely not.
Same pressures? Easier?
About a week before I left BAA, a business editor who should remain nameless phoned me up and said, Tom, the problem about you at BAA was you made it boring. I immediately wrote an email to my chief executive, my chairman, because for a lot of businesses, boring is good.
Yeah.
And boring means they can get on with their business. I don't think BAA are saying that in a minute, after Christmas. But the reality is, and I think this is true for a long time and under successive governments, there was an unholy alliance between politics and finance, which was finance got on with its thing, paid its taxes, and politics more or less left it alone. The problem post the financial crisis is that's no longer sustainable. Politics can't lead finance alone. Finance has to come to terms with politics. And I think we are seeing the process of business as a whole trying to come to terms with the fact that it is now part of the political debate.
I want to, in our remaining 20 minutes, just sharpen this up a little in terms of learning points for the new team, because there is a new director of communications, number 10, and he's will face quite a lot of questions, the political versus civil service option in terms of briefings, the nature of on the record, off the record, unattributable, televised. We touched on briefly, although people didn't respond. I'll give you a chance to say it to Peter's point, which is actually the Prime Ministerial news conferences became just part of the furniture remarkably quickly and are quite often not featured on television news bulletins.
And that's good.
They're always on rolling news, but they're not there. And the same might be true of televised briefings. It could be argued. Yeah. So there's a couple of things, but let me take some other questions first. I'll take a little bunch because they may point them out. Robert, Charlie Beckett, there's one at the back. Forgive me, sir, I don't know you, or I can't recognise you from here. Maybe it's my eyesight.
Robert Hazel, Fellow of the Institute. I want to re-ask two questions that have been put, but the panel didn't do justice to.
Poor chair.
One is about the coalition. Tom, you said ultimately number 10 has to get a grip and drive things. But when there are two parties in the government and the dilemma for the junior partner is how to get their distinctive message out, what would your advice be about the government's overall strategy and message media management? And the second question, what do you think the balance should be between special advisers giving briefings to the media and handling the media and official spokesmen from the GICS? And is it possible to draw a neat line between those two?
I promise to pursue answers on both, but I'll just take some other questions so that we get through them. Charlie.
Yeah, Charlie Beckett, from the London School of Economics. Perhaps I'd like to ask you in a sense about crisis communications, but I won't. I tweeted I was coming here on this morning, and somebody tweeted me back a question, which was, could you ask the panel, do they think that a government could actually say what it's going to do at an election? In other words, the implication, could they have been much more honest at the last election about the challenges they were going to face, and would that have made a difference? And the implication of that is, how informed do people really, does the public really need to be? Because obviously Nick and the others were trying to ask those questions at the last campaign, and they weren't really answered. But does that really make any difference?
Interesting. Question at the back. Ian Corby, I run a pooled research team for coalition MPs. Two fundamental tenets of the way this government is trying to operate is around localism and then within Whitehall, decentralisation. Is it the case that government communications, wanting everybody to sing from the same hymn sheet, is going to be an enemy to that? And will the media accept the fact that it's not always the minister's or the prime minister's fault?
Let's pick up on that, and it relates to, I think, Robert's question about the coalition. It seems to me, I'll put a view on the record here, that the fact that there was a coalition suddenly made split stories a damn sight less exciting and interesting than they'd previously been. I mean, the defining story of the major government in the end, if you discount sleeves, which is a quite big thing to discount, but was splits. I mean, there was a joke that...
Well, we were split.
Yeah.
And we were a coalition. I mean, John Major said that himself.
But there was a joke, in fact, I think there was somebody in the lobby with an F key that began in another startling example of a split in the government, ..
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me in the early days of the coalition, there was a sort of quite widespread acceptance, partly because of the mood that the Prime Minister set, which is, well, of course, people have different views, there they are. Now, it sometimes is more uncomfortable. It goes to the core of what Robert said. As parties, as the two parties of the coalition, feel the need to assert their identities more ahead of elections, and may well be after this set of elections if they both feel they've done rather badly, how does government deal with that? And does that negate messages about localism and centralism? Let's begin with that one, if we can.
Well, I do think it's an interesting question, because I think in terms of the coalition, I think Nick's right. There is a permission to disagree. There's a permission to disagree in terms of emphasis, whether it's an A-B or a multiculturalism and so on, and I think that's actually perfectly legitimate. But in the end, governments have to come to decisions. In the end, you can approach an issue like Libya from different standpoints, but in the end, you actually have to decide something. You know, politicians think that being in opposition, the problem is all you've got is words, that's all you've got. Well, the real problem is once you go into government, you've got words and deeds, and the two things have to be synchronized, because if they're not, you end up in a situation where, you know, the Prime Minister in his multiculturalism speech says more people have to learn English, but at the same time, you're cutting down language training funding. So you've got to have word and deed actually synchronized with each other, and that's actually quite difficult.
But why is it a problem, Tate, on Libya? Nick Clegg was asked, after the Times reported something, I'd done something similar on today, that there was an active government debate about how to respond to Libya, sort of goof, as it were, in shorthand, versus Hague. Nick Clegg said, you're right, we're having a debate, we're having an argument around the government. And jolly healthy it is too. Now, I think it's a really interesting question for government communications. Can that sustain, or are you saying, forget it, guys, that's
no, you can't actually make a virtue out of having a debate, but you then have to come to the decision. And, you know, whether it's in America or the UK or NATO as a whole, at some point they're going to have to make a decision. Because not making a decision is making a decision.
Yeah.
And that's the key.
And at that point, do the people who disagreed with that course of action have to pretend that they did agree? Or do they say, no, we on this occasion we gave up and we were outvoted?
Well, we saw that on student fees. That's exactly what did happen. They had to swallow their pride with a great deal of difficulty and swallow the promises they'd made before the election. I think you're perhaps confusing two things here. I don't think, from the point of view of number 10 communications, the coalition changes that much. I think it's just this is the honeymoon, and therefore there aren't that many difficult splits happening. They will get difficult. And if I were them, I would try and sign some sort of armistice of spin with the media before it gets into the ugly phase, which it certainly will, as it did with Gordon, as it did with us, as it did with John Major. If I were them, I would try and get onto some sort of new understanding with the media about how they're going to handle this sort of stuff, especially with a new communications director.
Which would be what? I mean, okay, if you were that director, what do you say to the
journalists
media?
Would stop spinning stories, they'd stop standing up in front of politicians making speeches, not allowing the speech to be reported at all and giving their view of the speech.
Yeah.
In return, the politicians wouldn't brief the speech in advance so that the speech itself is worthless. They would actually try and come to some sort of understanding of how they're going to do these things.
You think there's a dialogue that could be had there about...
I think it's a more grown-up dialogue you could have about politics, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a laudable ambition.
Yeah, maybe.
I think it's a real challenge to achieve. I do think your point about the new technology.
That was a version of Brave Minister.
Well, I think it requires too many people with disparate interests to come together. But I think the new technologies, you know, the internet does give you more opportunity there, because, you know, John Major used to have his little bit of shtick, which is he gives a 40-minute speech, he gets 3 minutes on the news. Nick Robinson says it was about Europe. The leader of the opposition says it was a load of rubbish but hasn't really read it, and the third party also plays in with their 30-second sign about who hasn't even read it. And the combination there is what does the viewer take away from that out of a bulletin? Not much clarity. These days, as Johnson says, we go to sites, we can see the whole speech. It's much, much easier now to read the whole thing, to see the whole argument, to go to Cameron's multicultural speech and actually follow the process. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, coming back to an earlier point about, you know, shifts. However, I mean, I agree that the print media has, you know, is fighting for its life commercially. You know, the age profile of readerships are shifting massively. But my one advice to Craig Oliver is underestimate the power of News International and Associated and The Telegraph at your peril. They are still huge powerhouses. They still invest vast sums of money and can send out huge armies of journalists to create massive trouble for you.
And
they drive the BBC and broadcast agenda because of the endless sort of pick-up out of the media. So although, you know, the structure of the market is shifting, their power within the system is still immense, and you underestimate it at your peril.
Now, the other point that Robert raised was the balance between political advisors, special advisors, and civil servants.
Yeah.
Now, we have in this government now a spokesman who, on the model that was set up at the latter period of the Blair government, was the civil servant, Steve Field. In this case, Tom, you used to do that job and share it briefly with Godric Smith. But you have a director of communications who's a political appointment, although in the shape of Craig Oliver is not a very partisan, in the sense of history, figure. So how does the government get the right balance? And I might ask you just to dwell on a story that's been in the news, the Prince Andrew story, where we had the interesting spectacle yesterday of the civil servant coming to the lobby to say that the briefings that had clearly, I wasn't there so I can say it without breaching confidence, clearly taking place at the party event at the weekend about Prince Andrew were not what the government thought. So you had a tension between the two.
Well, I think there's a very technical term to describe how you can manage a relationship, and that's called common sense. And David Hill was a political appointee. David Hill was partisan. David Hill briefed on behalf of the party. I briefed government policy. Now, we talked probably about 20, 25 times a day. Our officers were meeting to each other. We walked in and out and so on. But I was very clear in my mind what was government policy, and he was very clear in his mind what was party briefing. And I think, you know, that sort of tactical common sense approach works. I think if you try and write down a series of rules, I think it's quite difficult, but I think in practice it can work. And I think what's happened at the weekend is, and I don't know the detail at all, there's obviously been some sort of disconnect in that process. And you pay the price for that kind of disconnect. But that comes back to what I was saying earlier. You've got to get the message right and dictate it from number 10, and it's got to be clear. And that obviously didn't happen.
And so do you feel, as the civil servant, that you were privy to as much information as the political appointees, such that when a story broke, you knew what to say?
Well, honestly,
there's always that question about whether the officials are given the status internally. To know what to brief.
In terms of party stuff, no, but I didn't want to be. In terms of personal stuff surrounding the Prime Minister, no, but I didn't want to be. In terms of policy stuff, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, whatever, yes. And, you know, I often thought that part of my job was just sitting in the den, listening to the discussion, absorbing it, because you then knew not just what was going to be decided, but why. And that's the key. You've got to understand the why.
John, I'm glad that the government has reversed itself on SPADs and is putting more into number 10. It's the right thing to do. The notion you can depoliticise number 10 is ludicrous. It is a political institution, and you need to have political people there. I think the example of how it doesn't work when you try and separate out and have a civil service spokesman was Christopher Mayer. I think when Christopher found himself in a position that he could brief on things and then suddenly had to stop because it was political, it became ludicrous. So you need to have that continuity, and as Tom describes it, you can do it in different ways as long as you have the political there as well as the civil service. If you try and just do it as a civil service press spokesman, you'll go back to the day of Bernard Ingham, where Bernard Ingham was notionally a civil service spokesman but became a political one.
He had to cover the...
Just to be clear, you don't mean they're there physically in the sense of every morning at an event so that the spokesman can say, actually, that's party, I'll turn someone, but you mean there's
someone
else...
That's what Christopher Mayer found himself in a position of doing. As long as you have an integrated political and civil service operation, it's fine.
Okay, let me move on then to Charlie Beckett's question, or the one that he was tweeted, for which we're grateful. Honesty, which in a sense is the thing hanging in the room here, isn't it? The elephant in the room. Can't really hang an elephant, can you? But there we are. It seems to me that in different ways, each of these governments we talked about, and whether they had a problem, gained a reputation for not being honest. That Sleaze did for Major. It's probably the least good example in terms of dishonesty with the media. But certainly, clearly, the Blair government over spin and then Iraq. And Gordon Brown's government over candour, in inverted commas, about the election that never was, the 10p tax, and indeed the whole issue of the deficit. That these were deeply corrosive and allowed journalists to say, and allowed the public to say, you can't believe what they say. And just last thought from me on this, just to stimulate the thought, it seemed to me that in large part, New Labour's learning point from the Tory era was not to be open. So on the debate on the euro, it was, for example, just say the political debate's been had. It clearly hadn't been had, but it suited Labour just to say let's not have the debate on the euro. Ditto immigration, I would argue. Ditto, we need to put taxes up to pay for the NHS. These are all examples of very important decisions taken in private where it was considered too dangerous to have an open conversation with the public. Now, a reflection. Media's fault? If you'd had an open conversation, would you have been toast? Or was that, are we paying a bit of a price for that style of
it's not political management? It's not a new issue. I was at a production of King Lear in Portsmouth on Friday night. And it's not a barrel of laughs in King Lear. I've forgotten that. But there was a good Belfast roar whenever Lear advised the newly blinded Gloucester to get a set of glass eyes to be like a politician who does see what he cannot. And you know, I thought, you know, it once again shows the problem. You know, on the one hand, people do want to get the sense that you're in control. The reality is that you're never in control. You're always on verges. The best you can hope for is to look like you know how to get control. And I think that's still different for this government. I think it's finding that out. I think the problem becomes whenever, and I admit I think we did this on the dossier, whenever you end up looking as if you're more certain about something than you can reasonably be, you've got to allow that reasonable doubt. The problem for the politicians is reasonable doubt then becomes interpreted by the media as you don't know what you're doing. And I think that's the area which I think the real debate has to be had. Does the media allow for instance that there isn't, in my view, a simple solution to Libya? There are a series of options and you have to debate how you take those options, but there's not a simple solution. And I think it's allowing that debate place, which I think is the real challenge.
But Nick, at the heart of this, isn't it our political system? That we are blessed with having sort of three major parties, which are broad churches. They're sort of coalitions of different interests. And there's an admirable sort of, you know, desire to have absolute clarity in manifestos, in campaigns, in communication. But the truth is that for some party leaders, there are issues within their parties, within these broad churches, that do not allow for that degree of clarity. And manifestos are hard fought in terms of their language and their content, and people have to sort of stick to that language and stick to those arguments. And that's the benefit of that is that we have a broadly stable and coherent political environment. I was in Israel last weekend, and you have, you know, an opinion and a view in a political party for every square inch of land. And you can do that, and you'll get real clarity from each of those parties about where they stand. But you don't have much coherence and much order.
But Tom's raised a really interesting point about Iraq as well, Jonathan, which is reasonable doubt. Could it have been possible to have said to the British public, we really believe there are weapons of mass destruction, we have damn good reasons to believe it, that's what our intelligence services tell us, and it's what the intelligence services of other countries tell us too. But we can't be certain. We're not gone. We don't know. They can't know. And we think on the balance of risks and the balance of probabilities. Could that have happened, or is the view that actually forget it, politics doesn't work that way?
Well, what you're doing in politics is making a case. You're basically a barrister. You're trying to make the case for what you're doing. So you have to make the argument. You know, it's real world come from the same on the one hand or on the other. The media aren't going to report it that way. They're going to say he's doing this. So even if you put in the caveats, that's not going to make it into the final cut of it. So politicians don't set out, in this country, in my experience, don't set out to be dishonest about anything. They try and make the best case for something because they're trying to push that particular case. And I think the question of honesty does lie on both sides. I mean, the number of times we complain to Sunday papers about a story being untrue, and they say, yeah, but it was a good story. And we said, but it's untrue. They said, no, I know, but it's a really good story. And there seems to be a sort of lack of honesty on both sides, which is, again, why I'd be pushing for my armistice.
I'm just going to test you slightly on this. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the Labour Party took a conscious decision that it could not risk going to the electorate saying, we need to put up your taxes in order to improve the public services. So there was code, schools and hospitals, investment. Mm. There was never an explicit debate about let's put up your taxes to improve public services. We know taxes went up. We know arguably the public services improved. Ditto the debate about the euro. It was a debate had in private. Ditto mass immigration. There was a great debate happening behind the scenes on mass immigration. Did it reduce inflation? None of these issues were really openly debated, and indeed people who disagreed with governments at the time were derided.
No, I don't know that I accept that. For one thing, manifestos are very... For example, in 1997 we ran on a very specific manifesto. We made a very small number of very limited promises, and actually we fulfilled all of those very quickly. And then people held us responsible for things we hadn't done that we hadn't said we'd do. So you get caught on that. In terms of policy making, once you're in government, things change. I mean, I feel a bit sorry for the Liberals. Yes, they made a promise about student fees, a stupid promise about student fees in opposition when they didn't expect to get into power. Once they're in power, they had to do something different.
Any other last comments just before we wind up, or questions from the room here? There's a three. I see Ben Brogan at the back. We'll start with Ben, and then gentleman here, and the lady here. We'll have to be very brief in questions and answers, because I know it's people have work to go to.
Ben Brogan, I work for the Daily Telegraph, and I'm a member of the lobby. I just wanted to pick up on what Tom was saying about the importance of being in the room. I think the big issue for the coalition at the moment is that certainly the civil servant, a very good guy called Steve Field, who is speaking for them, gives the impression of not being in the room. And certainly there's evidence that at the key morning meetings, David Cameron, for his own reasons, decided that it wasn't worth having Steve in that room to hear the conversations about what the government is doing and how it's trying to do it. And I think the most important thing for somebody who is communicating to the lobby is that that person needs to be aware of the internal conversation, aware of the Prime Minister's thinking. And I think that has been one of the deficits they've had. The other issue for them, I think, is that there isn't a clear one person to talk to. I think certainly under Tony Blair and under Gordon Brown, if you worked for the lobby, you knew the single person you needed to be in touch with to find out what was going on and get the Prime Minister's thinking. And it's fair to say that for the last 9 months or so, it's never been entirely clear who in number 10 you ring up to find that information.
Endorse that fully. Yes,
gentlemen
in the middle.
Colin Seymour Ewer from the University of Kent. This is probably a naive question because I come from the country. If you've got a political director of communications in number 10, if you've got the official spokesman and you can keep all these things nice and tidily clear, do you nonetheless, in an era when you've got to keep control of the agenda, even if it's a silly agenda, the best you can, should you have political backup at ministerial level? Because if you don't, the Prime Minister is just not going to succeed in getting his agenda across.
Thank you. And there's a lady here who has her hand up in the middle. Can we just get the microphone over there? Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Liz Lovren from the British Chambers of Commerce. I'm interested just really briefly in the comments on the internet about the age of the internet. Not least, you all seem to be fairly positive about it, and my assumption as a PR person would be that it actually makes controlling the media message much more difficult, and just be interested in some really brief thoughts on that.
What I'm going to do is, instead of you all picking up all of them, I'll make sure that each of them are answered, but pick one that appeals to you. And maybe, because we ought to wind up as people have other places to go to, maybe three, if you can think of three, tips to Craig Oliver when he's watching this on the internet while pretending to see it. Tom Kelly, which of those questions do you fancy picking up or alluding to?
Well, being in the room, you have to be in the room. I actually didn't spend, I don't think, as much time as Alistair did talking about lobby with the Prime Minister, because I didn't need to, because I understood where he was coming from and issues, and it had to be a pretty big issue. And Jonathan was also very helpful, because I could Google Jonathan and say, you know, what's his thinking, etc. But you have to be there for the big discussions. You have to be there. And you know, as people organise it in a different way, but that's the bottom line. You just have to be there. Otherwise, you don't know where they're coming from. The transparency issue. For me, the internet is part of the transparency tide. And you know, it's one thing to... it does create difficulties. Like some of the things that Jonathan and I did in the peace process would not have been easy to do if we had thought about the EEL was going to push it out. But transparency, it's an issue that is with us. There's no point fighting it. You just now need to work out how you comply with it and still do your job. Three tips. Be on time for the convoy. be aware that walking up number 10 you're going to be photographed. And thirdly, in number 10 you've got influence. You don't have direct levers of control over the rest of Whitehall, but you do have influence, and you must use that, because at the end of the day, if you're not ahead of the curve, I suppose that's my bottom line, get ahead of the curve, because if you don't get ahead of the curve, it sure as hell is going to come and wash you away.
Tom's right about influence, but influence is tremendously helped by good process, and whatever mechanism is out there, I don't know what mechanism works inside number 10, connecting it to the Cabinet Office and out to wider government departments, but you know, on many, many occasions, you know, I know that skins were saved by the fact that early sight of issues coming up from departments, a proper process to gather it up, proper process to manage it in the centre is absolutely central. And so whatever Craig has, and we have Ginny Gray sitting here in front so she could tell us, make sure that that process works. I wasn't quite clear on your point about political backup. Mm. I mean, were you suggesting that somehow a minister for...
It should be a minister for Downing Street, as it were. Almost like a minister for Downing Street.
I think. Well, my experience of this, you know, was that you used, if you were in that role, you had access to ministers, and you used the Chief Whip, the Leader of the Commons, the Leader of the Lords as your political sounding boards. If you were treading into territory where you needed political guidance, and clearly the Prime Minister pressures on his time and availability intense. What I don't think does work is, and I went when I took on the job in 04, I went to talk to Bill Deeds, who was the last Minister for Information Communications under the Macmillan government. There's not been one since. And his advice in the end was a guinea. He found it very, very hard, he said at that time, different media age, to keep up with the... And he had to defer to the person who was inside number 10 doing that job at the time. And I think when people rehearse whether when Peter Mandelson went into the Cabinet Office in 97, whether he could do that role, I think the political tensions between politicians make that extremely difficult to deliver.
I don't want people here to be late for their convoys.
No,
I'm conscious. Over-answering. Three tips, if three come to mind.
Or even one. My process point is my tip.
John.
Just firstly on the lobby, I don't agree with Hal and with Tom. I think that actually you should televise the lobby briefing. I think the lobby is a fair part of the problem with the way the politics is reported in this country. We never solved it. We tried to make it more open by putting it on the record, by bringing on the specialist press in the hope that would make the lobby journalists behave better, which completely failed. There's a certain incestuousness to the whole thing, which you need to try and break open. And I can't really see the problem with televising it. I know ministers like to be on television themselves, but they still will be. It works perfectly well in an American system. It works perfectly well in other systems. I don't see why you shouldn't have a spokesman who can go up and say things. If you remember during the Falklands War, having that wonderful guy who was sort of very deadpan, reporting everything was a complete trial.
Ian McDonald.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. Yeah. Let's have more Ian McDonalds on our televisions. My three tips. One, try and deal now again while you're on the honeymoon with the problem with spads. You don't want to end up with more McBride balls type people out there briefing. Otherwise, you spend your whole time trying to clean up after that poison that spreads through the system. It's difficult to do, but worth trying to. Secondly, speed kills. Don't get rushed by journalist deadlines or the timetable of the lobby as we did on sacking Peter the second time. It's just not worth it. Absorb the pain. And lastly, don't let prime ministers go to the back of planes when the lobby are travelling with you. It always leads to trouble. It led to trouble for Cameron over Libya. It's a terrible mistake.
Then we wouldn't go.
That would be
terrible. Yes, you would. Yes, you would.
That's the real answer. The real answer is that would be terrible. I leave you with this thought. Yes, I've always known that there was a secret plot of all governments to get journalists away from foreign trips, which would be a source of great amusement to all of us here. I leave you with this thought when we're talking about government communications. I once naively said to Tom during a big rolling story when I think I was on 24 Hour News, I said, but wouldn't it just be helpful, because I'm here on the street all the time, if you could just fit, we could use the toilets inside. And Tom said, then you'd feel comfortable here in Downing Street. It's worth remembering.
Just to complete the thought, part of the problem we had in Northern Ireland during the peace talks was far too many journalists outside and all the parties went out and briefed them. we took away the toilets from the car park, and fewer journalists turned up. Therefore, there are fewer leaks from the talks process. So it works.
Well, in both senses.
There were fewer leaks in all ways. let me just thank, before Andrew does, our panel and say I hope you've had a little bit of a kind of Radio 4 reunion feel. Yeah. Where you nostalgically go through old stories, but also some pointers to the future. And thank you very much for your questions, Andrew.
It's been a great session. If it's had one weakness, it's been that everyone, being so civilised, has been agreeing with each other too much. We intend to put this right in the third in the series, which will be Peter Oborne and John Lloyd debating the motion, are they all lying, cheating bastards?
About the journalists.
This will be... this will be the last chapter of Nick's book. At least I imagine it will be. Thanks very much for coming, and thank you very much to all our guests to give us... Thank you very much.